Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
COVID-19 is hitting black Chicagoans hard. Of course, baseline health disparities play a role, and many African Americans in Chicago are considered essential workers, holding down jobs, driving buses, or working in grocery stores. As the pandemic continues to bring health and economic hardship, there are calls for attention to underlying racial inequities. From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore reports.
While black residents make up about 29% of Chicago's population, a whopping 72% of the people who've died from COVID-19 in Chicago so far are black. That's according to cases analyzed from Cook County Medical Examiner records. Linda Ray Murray is a retired doctor who teaches at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. She says this high mortality rate for blacks doesn't surprise her.
It makes me furious. It makes me angry. For African Americans, we have higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of high blood pressure, higher rates of coronary diseases, and many other medical conditions that make people more vulnerable to having bad outcomes with this virus.
The first person in Illinois to die of COVID-19 last month was a black woman named Patricia Friason. A week later, her sister, Wanda Bailey, died. Both had underlying health conditions. Again, while 29% of Chicagoans are black, the city's health commissioner says they account for 52% of those testing positive so far. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says the numbers take her breath away.
This is a call to action moment for all of us. When we talk about equity and inclusion, they're not just nice notions. They are an imperative that we must embrace as a city. It's unacceptable. No one should think that this is okay.
Mayor Lightfoot announced a racial equity rapid response team. The idea is to work with community leaders to create a system of checking in on people and monitor what's happening, and then direct resources to vulnerable communities. While stay-at-home orders may be effective for people who can telework, local and national data show more of those employees are white, higher-wage workers. According to census data in Chicago, blacks and Latinos are more likely to be essential workers holding down jobs like cooks and janitors. In addition, minority communities don't have equal access to health care. And the pandemic death toll underscores just how crucial health insurance is. Lightfoot says social distancing can be hard in communities where people must take the bus or live closer together. And she says the urgency of this crisis brings all these issues to light.
They are literally matters of life and death.
Helene Gale agrees. She has the Chicago Community Trust, which is co-managing a COVID relief fund. She's a former CEO of an international humanitarian group that helps communities recover from disasters like earthquakes and famine.
We used to talk about building back better, and that when communities were impacted, whether it was by natural or human emergencies, can we use the work that we're doing in emergency response to actually build a bridge to longer term so that we are building greater resiliency?
Gale says it would be impossible to learn from this pandemic without considering the role racial disparity is playing. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Moore in Chicago.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, April 7, 2020, so I have been told. Man, we have frequently had really uncanny timing with some of our broadcasts over the years, just times that we chose to have guests on or topics or books, but to be in the midst of a global pandemic with, you know, the word unprecedented is used at a historic rate by the hour, just to catalog all of the just extraordinary responses and everything that is happening around the reported virus. And to get the latest reports, it started about the end of last week that black people in cities like New Orleans, Louisiana, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Chicago, Detroit, that they were black people specifically, not black and brown people, although I did see a few of those reports, but generally speaking, it has been black people. They didn't say black and brown people make up 72% of the deaths in Chicago from the coronavirus, 40% in the state of Illinois overall, to one of the reports that I've read. They didn't say black and brown, they said black people. But to be reading this book, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954, to be reading this book at this time. Doing what we are supposed to be doing, and hopefully it'll be constructive. I know we have listeners in Chicago, and with our narrator in Chicago. Wow. We are finishing up the text today. I'm glad we had the opportunity. Our narrator, Henry, in Chicago was right there. I had the audio in hand last week, and we could have wrapped this up and moved on to a new book on Thursday, which we will do, but we would not have had to do this kind of, you know, added amendment segment, if you will, appendage. We could have just done this all Thursday, but I said, you know, hey, we might as well take our time and just go ahead and get through it. Plus, it would have made that program about 4 hours. So I'm glad we did so, because Chicago, those reports had not started to come out. It was Louisiana, New Orleans specifically was the first city where they were saying, oh, man, so many black people are dying from the coronavirus. And then it gradually began to go to other cities. And then Chicago just, I mean, wow. Again, Dr. Welsing, we talked about her so much last week. She was born in 1935, born in Chicago, Illinois. Talked about that last week, and the fact that she probably saw some of the beautiful block and beautiful neighborhood programs that we talked about last week to beautify and clean up the slums in the South Side and black parts of Chicago. And then she, Dr. Welsing, and so frequently in her lectures would talk about get an A+ in broom, get a PhD in sweeping and not throwing down trash in areas where black people live. I would have played an audio of her saying that had it not been for just... Let me read the Chicago Tribune, among many. The New York Times had a big report, the Chicago Tribune. Last week, the Times-Picayune. It's just been tons of these. NPR, that report that we heard came from NPR. But the Chicago Tribune, their report, Chicago's coronavirus disparity, black Chicagoans are dying at nearly 6 times the rate of white residents. Indeed, some of the hardest hit communities of the South and West Sides have struggled with unemployment and health care access for generations, Packing Them In. As a result, residents have higher baseline rates of diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, and high blood pressure, the chronic conditions that make coronavirus even more deadly. Even before the pandemic, these chronic conditions attributed to a life expectancy gap in the city. On average, white Chicagoans live 9 years longer than black residents, with half of the disparity due to chronic illnesses and smoking rates in black communities, public health officials said. I have a double pause there because the reports that I've seen, white people begin smoking at earlier ages than black people. Black people start smoking later in life than black people and smoke fewer cigarettes generally than white people, unless I have been misinformed, but the results end up being more deadly. So I have kind of a double, like, the disparities because of cigarette smoke, like, really? Not cigarette smoking is horrible. Sobriety would be best. That includes cigarettes. that was included in Harriet A. Washington's A Terrible Thing to Waste, so certainly no smoking. But the other half is that was in Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, the environmental racism, having all the promotion and marketing of cigarettes in the neighborhoods. That is a part of the packing them into these, you know, unhealthy environments and dump toxins and poisons on them and cigarettes and bad food. And oh my God, the Negroes, oh, they're in terrible shape. Diabetes, it looked like if you sneeze on one, they'll all die. And there you go. But this is the epilogue that we will finish up. Should be a lot more significant given everything that we are experiencing. And man, oh man, I think it has some really constructive portions that will be extremely prescient to what we are experiencing right now. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, one tiny segment and we're all done. Packing Them In, Context of White Supremacy, one and only audio segment for the day.
Epilogue, Raisins in the Sun, Postmodern Environmental Justice Struggles in Chicago. The title of the epilogue comes from the famous 1959 play, A Raisin in the Sun, by African-American playwright Lorraine Hansberry. It was chosen to reflect how elusive the dream of sustainable housing and communities became for the majority of African-Americans in Chicago for most of the 20th century because of their social construction as environmental leopards, regardless of class. To much critical acclaim, Hansberry's play successfully portrayed the struggle of African-Americans in Chicago in the mid-20th century to obtain sustainable living space, as well as the resistance they encountered both personally and publicly in trying to obtain that dream. Unlike Hansberry herself or her fictional younger family, the majority of African-American families found themselves unable to achieve the dream of living in a sustainable community until the 1970s. Large-scale movements of African-American entry into white suburbia did not take place until after the passage of the 1968 Fair Housing Act, specifically directed at ending discrimination in lending and real estate practices. Prior to the 1968 Fair Housing Act, the vast majority of African-Americans in Chicago packed into unsustainable and unhealthy racially segregated geographical spaces. A 1965 study by the Chicago Urban League on housing patterns for African Americans concluded by 1960, 96% of all Negroes in Cook County and 76% of all Negroes in the state of Illinois lived in Chicago's huge black metropolis. The dismal environmental state of these African American communities was reflected by the fact that two out of every five homes, 41%, were classified as dilapidated, deteriorating, or lacking plumbing facilities as compared to one out of five or 18% of all units occupied by white families. Their dreams were thwarted by the City of Chicago's urban community conservation movement, redlining, and federal policies that prevented the entry of African Americans into white suburban spaces, even after restricted covenants were struck down in 1948 and legal segregation was found to be unconstitutional in the 1954 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education. The City of Chicago's urban community conservation movement, created in the early 1950s, was, in actuality, a massive relaunching of the slum clearance and ensuing urban renewal program that had first begun in the Depression era with the passage of the Housing Act of 1937 and was further supported by the Housing Act of 1954. This movement was the foundation of the city's urban renewal project, which could not proceed without the critical participation of the Chicago Housing Authority, CHA. The CHA was primarily tasked with relocating the African American population that lived in the targeted slum clearance and urban renewal areas into public housing. Between 1954 and 1967, the Chicago Housing Authority constructed more than 10,300 public housing units, and a mere 63 of them were built outside poor, racially segregated neighborhoods. Chicago's slum clearance and its urban renewal programs were typical of those across the country that reconcentrated African Americans into even more racially concentrated geographical spaces. In their seminal work, American Apartheid, Segregation and the Making of the Underclass, urban scholars Douglas S. Massey and Nancy A. Denton concluded that the raising of neighborhoods near racially threatened areas did check the spread of urban blight and saved many areas, but Black critics complained that urban renewal simply meant Negro removal, and the evidence largely bears them out. According to Massey and Denton's study, urban renewal destroyed more housing than it created. Planning scholar Sigmund C. Shipp concurs with Denton and Massey's conclusion in her essay, Winning Some Battles But Losing the War, and points out that Negro removal was synonymous with urban renewal and was referred to as Negro clearance program, with its goal being the creation of a white middle-class neighborhood. Research on this phenomenon has found that between 1957 and 1961, almost two-thirds of those persons displaced by urban renewal projects nationwide were Black or Puerto Rican. The slum clearance and urban redevelopment activities in Chicago were typical of many similar efforts across the country and caused thousands of African-American communities to be bulldozed and their residents packed into even more racially segregated public housing. The outcomes of Chicago's race-based resettlement policies implemented by the CHA in direct support of the city's urban renewal programs were eventually found to be illegal on February 10, 1969, by federal judge Richard B. Austin. Austin's decision was based on the finding that the CHA had imposed a racial quota in four predominantly white projects: Trumbull Park, Lathrop, Lawndale Gardens, and Bridgeport, and that CHA family housing was 99% occupied by Blacks, and that 99.5% of its units were in Black or racially changing neighborhoods. This federal judicial decision emerged after Chicago African American community activist Dorothy Gottschall and several other African Americans filed a legal complaint against the CHA in 1966. They felt that it was illegal and unjust that CHA residents had no choice but to live in segregated, high-poverty neighborhoods. They charged that the CHA and U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's action of concentrating more than 10,000 public housing units in isolated African-American neighborhoods was a violation of the U.S. Constitution that guarantees all citizens equal protection of the law and the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlaws racial discrimination in programs that receive federal funding. In the legal decision of September 11, 1973, by the Court of Appeals of the Seventh Circuit, the judges stated that anyone reading the various opinions of the district court and of this court quickly discovers a callousness on the part of the appellees, CHA and HUD, towards the rights of the Black, underprivileged citizens of Chicago that is beyond comprehension. The Gottschall case eventually reached the Supreme Court, where the Court of Appeals decision was upheld by a vote of 8-0 on April 20, 1976. The Gottschall case was, unfortunately, the manifestation of the predicted fears that were articulated by African-American leadership between the 1930s and early 1950s, especially those of Chicago Urban League president and NAACP attorney Earl B. Dickerson. The fears were that even more severely unsustainable communities would be created by more austere racial segregation from slum clearance programs. Many in the African-American community and their interracial supporters failed to successfully act to alleviate these fears because, as discussed earlier in this book, public housing for African-Americans was perceived as the optimal environmental solution to blighted slum conditions in Chicago. Planning scholar Sigmund C. Shipp points out that some middle-class African-Americans, as well as representatives of the local branches of the NAACP and National Urban League, spoke in favor of urban renewal because they saw them as ways to improve deteriorating Black neighborhoods. Interestingly, for many Chicago African-Americans in the Great Depression, World War II and the post-war era, the American dream of a safe and healthy community was the public housing unit. This mentality was boosted by the development of public housing projects like the Ida B. Wells Homes and Altgeld Gardens in the 1940s. These public housing units were frequently portrayed as almost utopian environments for urban African Americans trapped in slum communities. African Americans desperately competed to gain entry into these housing units to escape the blighted conditions the new units were designed to replace. The irony of this particular environmental solution, public housing, was that its implementation would result in African Americans, especially those who were unable to buy homes even after racial housing policies had been relaxed in the latter half of the 20th century, being placed in less sustainable communities than those that had existed under slum conditions prior to the redevelopment movement. The public housing communities typically had none of the stores, jobs, or amenities of their former neighborhoods. These public housing communities became unsustainable in every sense. The entry into public housing was not representative of a dream deferred, but a dream gone bad. The ensuing exploding dream was the unforeseen and disproportionate environmental health problems, many times deadly, eventually associated with public housing and the inner city because of dismal levels of indoor and outdoor pollution. These communities also became the geographical spaces that were saturated with gang violence, illegal drugs, and prostitution. Future deadly levels of asthma and lead poisoning, especially among children, were unimagined by residents who willingly packed themselves into public housing. African American adults and children became the metaphorical raisins in the sun because their immune systems were compromised by the environmental conditions produced by the urban environment and infrastructure of the revitalized and redeveloped city. Today, the African Americans living in these public housing units are those who are most environmentally impacted. The majority of them belong to the underclass, as defined by sociologist William Julius Wilson. Unfortunately, today's class of African Americans has been unable to launch a citywide environmental movement like that of the Urban League to address the environmental problems that plague the urban poor. Their impotence in addressing these issues of environmental justice is directly related to the fact that they do not have at their immediate disposal the community resources that once existed in the legally racially segregated era, which had a vertically integrated African-American community, 1915 to 1970. They do not have the same benefits or resources of an upper-class and middle-class African-American community to help fight the environmental inequalities that they face in the new millennium. The most extreme example of this twist of environmental fate for African Americans living in public housing is Altgeld Gardens. The predominantly African American public housing community of Altgeld Gardens consists of approximately 10,000 residents and sits in the center of a toxic donut. The term toxic donut is a metaphor for the environmental space that the public housing community occupies. It is like the whole of the donut surrounded by heavy industry and waste dumps. My first visit to the community in April 2002 brought me south along I-94 into what seemed to be a highly isolated ecological and environmental paradox of forest preserve and a massive industrial complex. The leafy hills rising up next to the highway conceal a mammoth water treatment plant with acres of sludge drying beds. The industrial complex is massive and contains more than 100 industrial plants, and 50 active or closed waste dumps. The area contains 90% of the city of Chicago's landfills. Altgeld Gardens was itself built on the edge of an old industrial waste dump. Although Altgeld Gardens was completed in 1944, prior to the launching of the city's 1950s urban community conservation movement, it was nonetheless invoked as the model of a sustainable African-American community for at least a decade. The official opening ceremonies for Altgeld Gardens in late August 1945 lasted for more than a week and drew local and national political dignitaries like Temple McFadden, chairman of the Illinois State Housing Board, Congressman William A. Rowan, Judge George A. Quillisi, Elizabeth Wood, executive secretary for the Chicago Housing Authority, Robert Sintman of the Federal Housing Authority, and Sidney P. Brown of the Metropolitan Housing Authority. McFadden would declare at the dedication ceremonies that these beautiful homes were the fulfillment of the democratic ideas, one of which is the right of every American, to a decent home in which to live and raise his family. The original residents of Altgeld Gardens arrived in this community almost 60 years ago during the Second Great Migration period, primarily as working class people, war workers in the World War II era. From its beginnings, Altgeld Gardens was a planned racially segregated community whose residents were primarily war worker migrants from the South in search of a promise of a better life for themselves and for their children. The development of Altgeld Gardens was part of a national and local planning philosophy that believed in isolating and separating blacks from the normal white community and represented at this time the ideal solution to the housing shortage and overcrowding produced by the large influx of African-American migrants from the South. The community was originally intended to be 1,500 temporary housing units created by the federal government for war workers and their families. The Chicago Housing Authority, however, convinced the federal government to make the development a permanent site, and the construction that began in November 1943 would be completed in less than 2 years at a cost of $9.5 million. The original 1,500 units were built on a 157-acre tract in the Lake Calumet industrial area on a vacant lot between 130th Street and Ellis Avenue. When it opened in 1945, 61% of its original 7,000 residents were children. The remaining 3,000 residents were adults. The planners of Altgeld Gardens had hoped to achieve the public housing mission of providing affordable housing to people with insufficient funds. The majority of these families found well-built, fireproof, two-story row houses designed by the architectural firm of Nice and Murphy. Each of the homes had front and backyards. All of the original housing units were constructed of brick and had slate roofs, 4-inch plastered interior walls, and concrete slab floors. Public housing historian Devereaux Bowley points out that because the community was built on the very outskirts of the city of Chicago, the planners had to make provisions for many community facilities. That included a Board of Health station, public library, 6-room nurseries for 240 children, auditorium, club rooms, teenagers lounge, 4 one-story buildings for elementary and high school classes, shopping center which contained a cooperatively owned food store, drug and variety stores, doctor's offices, beauty and barber shops, a tavern, playgrounds, a community center, and a city park. Unfortunately, Altgeld Gardens was built on top of the former Pullman Sewage Farm, located on the southeast corner of Indiana Avenue and 130th Street, that was used to dispose of municipal and industrial sewage sludge. The land for the farm was originally prairie and was acquired by the Pullman Land Association. Every industrial process generated during this period more than likely was sent to the farm where liquid wastes were deposited on the soil. The soil filtered the waste. Construction of the sewage farm began in 1880, and its operation began in October 1881. 211 million gallons of waste were transferred to the farm in 1882, with steadily increasing volumes until 1892, when 698 million gallons were handled. The waste consisted of both municipal sewage from the town of Pullman, along with waste from the shops of the Pullman Railcar Manufactory. The land used for sewage purification was also used for growing crops such as onions, potatoes, cabbages, celery, and beets. The sewage farm remained in operation until 1907, when the industrial waste streams were then sent untreated into the Little Calumet River. According to the Illinois Department of Energy and Natural Resources 1985 study, the Pullman system also handled liquid waste from Sherwin-Williams, known to contain sulfuric acid, arsenic, copper, lead, zinc, chromium, iron, and sodium sulfide. The charges of health problems tied to environmental racism elucidated by Altgeld Gardens residents is specific and insidious. The residents have argued that their environmental health problems are directly linked to the original land use as a sewage farm and the more contemporary use of the site for the illegal disposal of PCBs by its landlord, the Chicago Housing Authority, CHA. Residents of Altgeld Gardens complain that rashes on children and unexplained illnesses in adults in the community were tied to chemical exposures from the sewage farm and local industries. In 1995, Altgeld Garden residents discovered that a PCB contamination site was first identified in 1984 by the U.S. EPA and the CHA. This area of contamination was not disclosed to residents until 1995 in response to the request under the Freedom of Information Act submitted by People for Community Recovery through the Chicago Legal Clinic. The fight for environmental justice in Altgeld Gardens was spearheaded by an African-American widow and resident of the community who had lost her husband to cancer, Hazel Johnson. Johnson's determination to find out why her husband and so many of her neighbors were dying from cancer led her to create the only public housing environmental justice organization in the country, People for Community Recovery, PCR. In June 1979, later incorporated on October 25, 1982. Although PCR has failed to date to obtain a former epidemiological study of the community, it has had independent health surveys taken for residents. One such survey was conducted in 1992 by Dr. Herbert White Jr., then regional medical director of occupational and environmental medicine at St. James Hospital in Chicago Heights. Trained surveyors completed a health survey of 200 randomly selected apartments with a total of 835 residents. Their results supported the historical beliefs of the residents regarding a community history of unusual health problems peculiar to their environment. The most disturbing findings in the report were that 50% of 270 pregnancies resulted in either miscarriage, 25%, stillborn babies, 7%, premature births, 12%, or babies who require special medical care due to their birth defects, 7%. The survey also revealed a high incidence of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease among residents that included emphysema and or chronic bronchitis. The 1992 survey indicated that 25.5% of the population surveyed reported having asthma, 32% of the men and 20% of the women. The survey also reported that 68% of those surveyed indicated that their health problems disappeared when they left the community. The health survey resulted in PCR's publishing a list of demands that was sent to local, state, and national government agencies. According to PCR, the list of demands was developed under the threat of artificially induced environmental destruction and the continued genocidal effects of people of color. The demands included the implementation of a comprehensive health study for residents of the southeast side of Chicago and a permanent local, county, state, and federal ban on all waste facilities to be located within the Lake Calumet region of Illinois. PCR also created a wall of death. This wall was the entire side of a building located near the offices of PCR. The objective of the wall from its inception until today was to commemorate those in their communities who had died from cancer and what they believed to be environmental illnesses. PCR's 25-year lament of being a poisoned community was particularly resolved in August 2003 when the federal court decided in the community's favor against the landlord, the CHA, and awarded a judgment of $100 million. The modern environmental justice movement has done much to document the fact that communities of the poor and people of color are being marginalized because their geographical spaces are used as dumping grounds for toxic and hazardous waste. These environmental policies and practices of putting waste in Black people's backyards ultimately have been linked to such environmental health problems as extremely high rates of mortality, infertility, cancer, and autoimmune diseases like lupus and asthma. The emphasis in much of this literature, however, has focused on contemporary problems faced primarily by Southern and rural African American communities and has failed to address the historical decisions that led to this phenomenon. Neither does this literature address the history of environmental racism faced by Northern African American communities and the industrial underclass like the Altgeld Gardens residents that arose directly from racist planning policies and practices to deal with the Negro problem as African Americans migrated north during the Great Migration periods. More than half a century after its debut as a model African American community, Altgeld Gardens became one of the country's most recognized geographical spaces of environmental inequalities. Its creation and subsequent environmental problems were based on decades of documented racist planning decisions and policies over which the residents had no control. It is important for future planners and policymakers to understand and to take into consideration the history of geographical spaces that emerge from race-based policies. Knowing the history of a place like Altgeld Gardens will contribute to a more honest and lucid discussion about remediating its current environmental dilemma. Knowing this history will also help planners and policymakers avoid future mistakes and resolve current problems that have evolved from historical planning decisions initially rooted in racist ideologies.
Context of white supremacy. I was just looking at that final sentence. Knowing the history will also help planners and policymakers avoid future mistakes. I don't think the toxic donut at Altgeld Gardens, I don't think that was a mistake. I could be in error, but generally speaking, bad things happen to Black people. Oh man, you got a community garden and a playground and fresh, sparkling new public housing units for the Negros. Oh, and you mean it's built on a former landfill. Oh, and it's got untreated sewage and toxic. Oh man. So your potatoes are. Oh, and that's generally. Yeah. That was a mistake. We looked at the files wrong, didn't we? Yeah, that's what happened. That was a mistake. This is the land of John Burge, ladies and gentlemen. Not 500 years ago, not 200 years ago. Last 15 years or so, John Burge, white man who terrorized folks in Chicago, heard a little bit of that before we went live, and he didn't even go to jail. I think they gave him a slap on the wrist for lying, but no jail time, no prison time. This is widely acknowledged terrorism in Chicago way before the Chinese virus got there and caused problems. Terrorizing Black people, electrocution of the testicles, and all the rest of it. Mistake? Incidentally, just today, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington, so we're reading this here book, Packing the Men, finishing it up, new book Thursday. They report every day and have been reporting every day pretty much since Saturday. 72% of the deaths in Chicago, Black people, from the so-called coronavirus. Finishing this book today. Seeing that information, I wrote Dr. Hood and said, man, your book prescient. It seems like passages from the epilogue that we just completed could have been clipped from some of the headlines from today in the Chicago Tribune and other sites that are talking about the death rate for black people. I emailed her and she said absolutely she would be down to talk. So this will be one of the few times that we will have the author of a book that we read in the book club coming on the program. I generally try not to do that, but man, and I mean, talk about rapid evolution. I'm going to get to the callers in a second. Just we're done with the book, so we can just chat. I was not very excited about this book initially. It's not Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, or A Terrible Thing to Waste, but I wasn't super excited. It's like, oh, okay, you know, we're going along. Let's see, you know, how it goes. It's not too long. Wow. By the time we've got to the end, Dr. Hood will be on the program in a matter of days. She already applied and said, you know, let's do it. So the evolution has been astounding just within the last 30 days. I think we started this book before all of the coronavirus was too intense. We started this book in February. So I think it was at that point just kind of a news report about what was happening in China. And there wasn't, you know, certainly no closings and shutdowns and all the rest. It certainly were not daily reports of black people dying in Chicago and New Orleans and Louisiana and Baltimore and Washington, D.C. and Detroit. Anyway, if folks have comments, we are wrapping it all up. Dr. Hood will be joining us. So if you gleaned some constructive information or thought it was useful or want to see how this relates to what's being reported right now with the coronavirus, she'll be with us in a few days. But for wrapping up this text right now, the number to dial 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, I can only say, wow. The timing of the cows has been amazing over these 11 years, right and exact time. Not only, as I said, to be reading this book, Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954, to be reading this book at this moment with the narrator, Chicago resident himself. Wow. Timing right and exact at the context of white supremacy. We'll get folks who dialed in if they have any thoughts. Again, the epilogue, that is it. We're all done. I believe the next book, I do need a little bit of help. I think one of our investors got my back, I think, to hold us down for this week. But I think the next book that we're going to read is Nutricide, Dr. Layla Africa, The Nutritional Destruction of the Black Race. There are multiple editions. Some editions, it's reversed. The title of the book is The Nutritional Destruction of the Black Race. Some versions, that's the title, and in other versions, Nutricide is the title. But it's the same book, I think, either way. I haven't been able to go through them line by line, but it looks like from the table of contents and such that I've seen, it looks like it's the same book. So, anyway. I do not have it in hand. And the irony, I had that book. I bought that book while I lived in Atlanta. Let me put it. I bought that book while I lived in Atlanta and ate chicken wings regularly. Tubby. I would eat chicken wings more often than I would even think about going to get that book. Although I would flip through it occasionally. Put down my chicken wing, my slice of pizza. And, oh, let's see what this doctor. Eat to live. Interesting. More chicken wing. But we are going to read Dr. Layla Africa, grandsister, just passed away. He's been a guest on the program before, but How could we not read that? We were going to read The American Problem, The Negro. That was what we were going to read. But given current events, this being diet related, Dr. Africa just passed. I just said we should do that anyway. The urgency got accelerated rapidly with everything that is taking place. So that will be the next book. As I said, I don't have it in hand. I think a listener got my back. But just in case, if anybody does have that book already, like you have it in hand, you have it where you can grab it off your shelf right now, I might need a little bit of help just to get us through the first week. I should have my book in hand by next week, and I'll be doing the narration, so we are all good. But just for this week, if somebody already has that book, might need a little help just so that I can do the narration for Thursday. I think a listener already has me, but just covering my bases, as they say. But that will be our book for Thursday. The Grandcestor, Dr. Layla Africa, Nutricide, The Nutritional Destruction of the Black Race. So that'll be three books in a row that are kind of connected. A little bit unusual, but wow, we are lined up beautifully for what we were supposed to be doing for 220 with the book club, at least. Like, this has been one of the worst years ever, but wow. Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste. Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago. Dr. Layla Africa, Nutricide, The Nutritional Destruction of the Black Race. I think with those three, if you have any understanding of racism, white supremacy at all, and those three books, you might be in a slightly better position understanding what's happening with the coronavirus situation and hopefully applying that information. Check your water. You're not doing Uber Eats and DoorDash for Wendy's, the Baconator, and all that other stuff to destroy your brain and your immunity system. A little more mindful about what you eat. Maybe got that HEPA filter inside so you can get some fresh air. Hopefully you live in an area where they have a little bit more fresh air. What you eat, extremely important. Alrighty, folks who dialed in, if you have comments, thoughts, final section of Packing Them In, folks with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. I have come to the point of making a habit of just dialing up the number to the program just in case I'm not aware of a scheduled program, and that's how I was able to come upon today's epilogue book reading. I would say all in all, including with the epilogue, that the book was informative, and it should be shared with someone who is interested into informing his or herself on the more refined means of the practice of racism, white supremacy. From the standpoint of by scientifically organizing and stockpiling people who are classified as not white, non-white, into areas, it makes it easier, apparently. It makes it easier to dwell out deal out mistreatment in a much more efficient fashion. And this book supports that behavior. It's on a global scale, but I think it's relevant that the writer wrote the book primarily to target on that scientific practice in this part of the world. because it would make it much more easier to accept and understand on that particular method of practicing racism and white supremacy. And the book was pretty much thorough with it. And it goes along with the other books that you mentioned. And coupled with this real life instance that's going on right now, all of that coming into the counter racist vacuum, it can really do a pretty good job to inform anyone who is interested in solving the problem of racism and white supremacy and replacing it with a system of justice soon as possible, I would say. I don't have one of the books, but as far as my attention to the readings, that's really what it's all been about. You know, it all adds up, is what I'm saying. There's nothing to me that doesn't make sense, you know, as far as on a overall scale in the book. I mean, if nothing's perfect, but I would say on an overall scale, there's nothing that doesn't really add up in the book itself. And I certainly would share it with someone who expresses to me that they're interested in solving this problem, to give them one more bit of information into their toolbox of understanding, I would say. I'll start off with that in the conversation. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Definitely. Share. Hope it's constructive. And if you live in Chicago, you live in the state of Illinois, if you're a victim of racism, this mandatory. Got to know local, national, global history, racism, white supremacy. But that, yeah, mandatory to be in your library if you are a Chicago native like Dr. Francis Cress Welsing.
The story is similar to other places. I can identify with that I learned in Chicago with certain sections in Miami-Dade County. As far as when they mention about the project and how they started off, first they willfully build it on grounds that is infected, but then to give some sort of illusion of this is a good thing. You know, they have these, you know, the community centers for, you know, and the facilities for children and all of that, and those things pretty much closed down within that project within about the first 3 or 4 years. You know, because of the lack of resources that the city and county is willing to keep up to help that environment, it dies off, and then it becomes just a brick in concrete structure. That's it. I'm gonna close my mouth. Thank you.
Hi, can I be heard?
Draftomania.
Can I be heard?
Draft
yeah,
him. Yes.
How you doing, Jess?
Right, poorly.
I figured you was going to say that. I understand. I'm right there with you. I really enjoyed the book. I think it did, like the firefighter was saying. It's like everything was synchronized. All of the different books that we've been reading back to back, it seems like, you know, they all fit into. They all fit together. It was all like synchronicity. And then the kicker was, you know, all of a sudden, as we were talking about, you know, doing the book, and doing this book club, then we had this, this pandemic come along, and then it was like all the pieces seemed to fit together, so you're able to, connect the dots with, the environmental racism and how it affects health, and, all these different, they talked about the health disparities and the, we talked about epidemics and experimentation and all these things. It all fits into exactly what's happening today. So this book really was very relevant. And like you said, you wouldn't have known that this would have been so relevant to what was going on today. But it just so happened that everything just all fit together. And I've been doing a lot of research because I've been having time to do research. And I've been doing some research in regards to the Chicago. And also, it's been talking about how New York numbers with black people and all of this stuff is coming out now, like you were saying. I think that they already knew this information, but they were withholding this information. The news is not going to tell you. People are looking for the news, for the truth. I don't think anybody in this audience does this, but I think overall, like society at whole, they look towards, to get information from the news, but we know better. And it's just information that they've been withholding. And where I work at, I work at a university, and some of the students were saying, in the beginning when this outbreak first happened, they were talking about, I guess it must have been posting things on Facebook and social media, and they were saying like how black people were immune to it, and they were saying, we don't have it, we can't get it. And then now, this is just my theory. I think that it was misinformation put out there just on purpose to make us think that we can't get it. And now, all of a sudden, all the numbers of people that are getting this virus are us, and we're the highest number. Like he was talking about, Chicago has a 72% out of a 30% population. It's almost like it reminds you of the prison population. We're the, we're the smallest in the population, but we're the highest in the prison population. So it's just the same old thing over and over. It just shows you, it just shows me that, it's white supremacy all over again, even when it comes down to this epidemic and this virus also. And I'm really excited. I've never read any of Dr. Layla Africa's books, but I'm looking forward to reading some of them in the future. Don't know if I'm going to be able to get his book on the side, but I look forward to listening and learning from the book that you're going to be reading. We're going to be reading on the book club, and I'm really excited about that. And thank you guys for all that you do, and I really appreciate the show, and I thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Dr. Layla Africa, Thursday, will be starting Nutricide. Again, if any listeners already have that book, let me know. Might need your help. Might not need it. Might be all good, but looking forward. I had forgotten, ironically, or I won't say ironically, but just talk about rapid evolution. I had forgotten, literally, it was like days ago. People were saying, oh, black people are immune to the Rona. They don't get that. That was days ago, literally. Like they would. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, we're all done packing them in. If you have any final thoughts.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the callers. One thing that astonished me when I went to Chicago, I think I said it before, was how large the public housing projects were. But just how much space they allocated to those projects, whereas on the East Coast, they kind of try to cram a bunch of buildings into a small area. But there, they were massive, like blocks and blocks and blocks. It's like, wow, they really allocated a lot of space to this. Ida B. Wells, it said, had 1,662 units, 860 apartments, 800 row houses. In the 40s, when blacks typically had more than one or two children, you know, you could see that this could have very easily been, if they just had three, it would have been 5,000 residents, you know, in this small, you know, this area. And I think at one point they had well over 10,000 in the Ida B. Wells homes. I think it was 11,000 at its peak, which is just, I mean, could you imagine, like, just way, way too much. The Orchid Gardens, the Toxic Donut. I just read up on it. It says there's 50 landfills and 382 industrial facilities surrounding the area. 1,498 apartments, two-story row houses, 190 acres. Like, that's a massive amount of space to allocate to, you know, these Negroes. But either way, this is a very big donut. Could very easily have had, you know, right now they say the total residents living on the grounds, because around the initial housing projects, I guess they built some mixed living uses, you know, low income housing and things. 8,000 people there right now living on this area, and same issues, the same industrial companies still right around them. In 2017, when the president proposed a huge budget cut to the Environmental Protection Agency, it says without proper funding, the EPA cannot fund the programs aimed at cleaning the area. So all of that's been terminated. So they're still going to be in that same condition. I looked up Altgeld to see who this was. Why would they name this 190-acre projects after this guy? And it was a white guy, a progressive politician. Progressive is a soft political term for socialist. She served as the governor of Illinois from 1893 to 1897, just one term. And I'm like, why would they name this after this guy? He was one-term guy, but what he was known for was pardoning the murderers of six police officers during the famous Haymaker riots in Chicago. He also sided with the Pullman during their strike and refused to send the police in to break the strike up, which led to the eight-hour workday, according to the article I read. So just very interesting. They named this after this guy. Here in New York, they canceled the summer youth jobs, and which essentially cancels the city's summer camps. So they're already planning way ahead with what they expect to be going on in the summer, as far as, I guess, coronavirus. But this is going to, you know, lead to a lot of problems with black people who work and depend on those camp programs. Where their children are safe during the daytime, like they depend on school and things. So this was a big hit, because those are generally decent paying jobs for the kids over the summertime. They get to clean parks and do the youth camps for the city and stuff. So that's not good. I need my wife. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Yeah, lots of planning ahead and shutting things down. I think in Chicago, they said they are shutting down after this week. They're shutting down. They had been doing some sort of like meal delivery service for Chicago public school children, because schools have been I'm not sure if they're closed for the year yet, but they've been closed for a while. But they were doing some sort of meal delivery service because, you know, a lot of children, they don't, if they are not in school, that's like a major source of food, being able to get meals at school. But they said they're shutting it down this week out of concern for safety for their drivers. So, yeah, problems abound with all of this. Let me double check 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Our caller in Canada, did you have commentary, questions, observations?
Greetings. I'm really happy that Dr. Africa is going to be on the book club coming this Thursday. It's a book that I've never read. I actually never heard of Dr. Africa until his transition on March 22nd, 2020. And it's a really sad thing that, you know, I became aware of him through his death. But I'm really happy that I had a chance to speak to Mr. Fuller. I was really disappointed that I didn't get a chance to speak to the late, great Dr. Francis Corster Wilson. But I think when we read the book, I think a lot of the questions that we may have had for decades, we're going to have our questions answered in Dr. Africa's book, because I've been listening to his videos on YouTube, and he talks about the fact that a lot of Black people are eating foods that they think are foods when really they are chemicals. They're actually not food. Like, sugar is not a food. Oil is not a food. Flour is not a food. Even the milk that we consume, it's not even designed for a person. It's designed for calves. And this diet is actually a military diet that Black people have been engaging for maybe 20 generations. And it's actually making us sick. So then we'll have the diabetes. Then we have the kidney failure and the high blood pressure and the glaucoma. This is why we're getting so sick. And then the people who practice racism stuck us, just like in the places, packing us in corners where we become sick and ill. And then when they want to, then when there's a disease, there's a pandemic that comes out, then we're more susceptible to die from these sicknesses. So, so I'm really happy about, you know, that we're going to have Dr. Africa's book on the cows. That's it, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, caller in Canada. Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Nutricide, the nutritional destruction of the Black race, either or. That'll be our next book. Looking forward to it. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Hopefully, we'll get some information that will be relative to current events, what's happening right now. I think that does happen sometimes where, you know, we unfortunately might not learn about a person or their work until they have transitioned. But, you know, time is right and exact. We get the information when we are supposed to. And I think the major point, as long as we get that information and apply it, if we can get that information and apply it so that we can live healthier, be an example, help other people, help other victims of racism, avoid some of those problems so they don't have diabetes and glaucoma and hypertension and all the rest of that stuff. So yeah, we can just take advantage. I'm sure Dr. Africa, hey, long as we get that information, are sharing and applying what we get, hey, better late than never, as they say. And take advantage. That's always great to get that reminder, because I remember a lot of folks, remember when Dr. Welsing transitioned, said, you know, man, I wish I had took advantage and got a chance to ask her a question or two or to talk to her. Take advantage. Folks who are here, if they have written work or done films, anything, written something, whatever, and or just, you know, they share views on white supremacy, racism, and you appreciate what they've done or have a question about something or would like to just get their perspective on something, go ahead and take the opportunity. You know, for one thing, they will not be here forever. So take your opportunity and ask your question. Any other folks, press star 6-1. I'll go through some of my notes and keep an eye on the switchboard. Let's see, scrolling back. So we just had the epilogue and all done. let's see. She started off, this is 193, she says, the dismal environmental state of these African-American communities was reflected by the fact that 2 out of every 5 homes were classified as dilapidated, deteriorating, or lacking plumbing facilities, as compared to 1 out of every 5, or 18% of all units occupied by white families. That, in my opinion, it's not a mistake. When you have that sort of, you know, hard data, and this is, you know, not ancient history, it's not from the 1800s or something, but just basic, talking about health. You live in dilapidated, deteriorating housing with no plumbing, you're probably going to have a lot of health problems. Indoor and outdoor pollution, they said. Let's see. The section I posted it this morning where they're talking about trying to get, like, all right, so we've crammed you niggers, you've ran from the South, you've ran up here to Chicago, and we've crammed you niggers into the worst part of the city down in the South End, put you next to Bubbly Creek and, you know, all the waste from the city. And so you want to get, okay, we'll get public housing. We'll move everybody out of these dilapidated units. It'll be great. Okay. And she shares in this passage here, she says, the irony of this particular environmental solution, public housing, was that its implementation would result in African Americans, especially those who were unable to buy homes even after racial housing policies had been relaxed in the latter half of the 20th century, being placed in less sustainable communities than those that had existed under slum conditions prior to the redevelopment movement. The public housing communities typically had none of the stores, jobs, or amenities of their former neighborhoods. These public housing communities became unsustainable in every sense. The entry into public housing was not a representation of a dream deferred, but a dream gone bad. The ensuing exploding dream was the unforeseen and disproportionate environmental health problems, many times deadly, eventually associated with public housing and the inner city because of dismal levels of indoor and outdoor pollution, just said. These communities also became the geographical spaces that were saturated with gang violence, illegal drugs, and prostitution. She said earlier in the book, she said that was deliberately moved, not a mistake, after the Great Chicago Fire. Let's move the vice to where the niggers are. Continuing, she writes, future deadly levels of asthma and lead poisoning, especially among children, that was exactly in Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, were unimagined by residents who willingly packed themselves into public housing. Pausing again, asthma, that right there, that is a respiratory illness that is listed as a cofactor with having severe, possibly fatal complications with the coronavirus. Asthma, living in densely populated, polluted areas, that is known to drive up asthma rates. Continuing, African American adults and children became the metaphorical raisins in the sun because their immune systems were compromised by the environmental conditions, poison, produced by the urban environment and infrastructure of the revitalized and redeveloped city. That paragraph right there sounds totally different given everything that has happened today, particularly if you make an epigenetic evaluation and say, okay, so this has been going on for generations. So what happens when you have like 3-4 generations of black people? Because they said sometimes these symptoms would improve when the person left. We heard that about the Flint situation, that some of the children, they were there and they were having all these symptoms and rashes and hair falling out and all this. And then they would leave, go stay with a relative or something. And miraculous. What's going on? My skin looks, look at that. I'm all melanin and shiny. Look at that. Feeling no rash and all the rest of it. I can think what's going on. You move out and things improve. So what's the impact of having generations where it's constant, not just this is impacting you, I'm here, I conceive a child in this environment. We talked about that with all the important things that happen during the developmental stages, and you get exposed to certain chemicals and things along that path, and it can have lifelong implications. So then you have generations go through that. Now, what's the impact of that, having generations of black people live in an environment that is designed to compromise your immune system? Scientific white supremacy racism. Let's see. They're right. This is next paragraph down. Oh, the toxic donut. 10,000 residents sit at the center of a toxic donut. Talk about metaphors. Now, see, even that toxic donut. Why are we calling it that? Like, really? Let's not call it a donut. Delectable Negro. Let's not call it a toxic donut. We would have to come up with a better name, like perimeter of poison. Like, it would have to be something. Like, it cannot be anything that in any way minimizes this, or is like we're making light of this. This is kind of funny, jokey. Like, we are surrounded by a perimeter of poison. That's what I mean. Like, you could take the term. Now, what is more accurate? Now, you can think, when we had that white woman, Anna Clark, on the program, and we were talking about the Flint situation, chemical and biological warfare, and it's, I have to think on it. Gives me pause. I'm thinking about it. Toxic donut? Chemical and biological warfare. Toxic donut? Chemical and biological warfare. Even Bubbly Creek. What the? Let's pick. Names are so important. That gives you a better grasp when you have accurate names. That helps you accurately grasp the world that we live in. You walk around, you know, calling a bag a fork, you know, you start looking at you a little funny. We want to call things by their correct names, by their most accurate names. That's how we start to make sense of the world. But the very next part, the paragraph, the toxic donut, waste dumps and all this. This is not a mistake. She says, my first visit to the community in April 2002 brought me along I-94 into what seemed to be a highly isolated ecological and environmental paradox of forest preserve and a massive industrial complex. The leafy hills rising up next to the highway conceal a mammoth water treatment plant with acres of sludge drying beds. The implants and 50 active or closed waste. The industrial complex is massive and contains more than 100 industrial plants and 50 active or closed waste dumps. The area contains 90% of the city of Chicago's landfills. Altgale Gardens was itself built on the edge of an industrial waste dump. So 90%, the statistics that have come out in the last like 3 days about Chicago. So 72% of the reported coronavirus deaths for the city of Chicago are black people. 90% of Chicago's landfills are in the Altgale Gardens area. 40% of the deaths from the coronavirus in the state of Illinois are black people. Those are just some of the statistics from the last like 3 days for Chicago, Illinois specifically. Like, wow. Not even a whole lot. And again, I just, mistake? Any of this? Mistake that is not accurate, in my opinion. Like 90%? I don't even know what happened to that. Like, when I see something like, you see that consistently. That was what we, a terrible thing to waste. They said the same thing about Houston. I think it was about 80, but it was about the same percentage too, about 80%, 90%. You already know we're going to get as many of these as possible. If we got five that we can't cram, if we can't pack five more waste and dump sites into where the coons live, then, you know, maybe we can find some of those brown people. Then we say it's black and brown. We'll find some brown people and dump it on them. But pack it in. Pack it. Get it. Got any, anybody got any more toxic sludge? Any more? We can dump some more on them. Let's see. On 199, you look at this. Mistake. Mistake. In my view, we get trained. We don't want to think all of this is deliberate. This is planned. We are at war. Racism, white supremacy is war against black people. This is not white people are ignorant. It's not that they're poorly informed. That came up in A Terrible Thing to Waste, where she said they were deliberately bringing them in where they knew these houses were contaminated with lead. And it was, let's bring them in and get the children so we can study. See how it's going to whoop them for the next 20 years. This one, she writes, the sewage farm remained in, or the land used for sewage purification was also for growing crops such as onions, potatoes, cabbages, celery, and beets. The sewage farm remained in operation until 1907, when the industrial waste streams were then sent untreated into Little Calumet River. I saw that on the map today. According to an Illinois Department of Energy and Natural Resources 1985 study, the Pullman system also handled liquid waste from Sherman Williams, known to contain sulfuric acid, arsenic, copper, lead, zinc, chromium, iron, and sodium sulfide. All of this is what Altgale Gardens was built on. I contend, not by accident. You got a list like that, like, good God. All of this is on the land. Oh, yes. Put your community down. Put your community garden down. That's going to be lovely. Make sure you don't need anything from the garden. They got all kinds of. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's going to be celery. You got celery? Yeah, don't eat anything from the garden. Yeah, they got. The coons got all kinds of sludge underneath it. You know. Yeah, it's beautiful. That's just beautiful. Got radishes. Oh, that's great. Yes. Let's get some picture of the new community garden. That's beautiful. It's not by accident. Whites do this sort of thing all the time. Remember that I keep bringing it up in A Terrible Thing to Waste. She said in one of the groups, they brought black people in. It weren't even any signs down to know that, oh man, we had a toxic waste dump here. We'll just let them play. And they called it pink slide because they would go and slip and slide on it. And then like 40 years later, like, wow, we got all this prostate cancer and lung cancer and half of the people are sterile. And, oh, it was the pinks. Oh, that was toxic waste. And what is the list here? Chromium and copper and lead and arsenic. Like, I thought arsenic was poison. Like, they don't have regulations about. Let's see. Next down, this is still on 199. Trained surveyors completed a health survey of 200 randomly selected apartments with a total of 835 residents. Their results supported the historical beliefs of the residents regarding a community history of unusual health problems. Wonder how all this happens. So you've got five eyeballs. Unusual health problems. I lost my place. Unusual health problems peculiar to their environment. The most disturbing findings in the report were that 50% of 270 pregnancies resulted in either miscarriage, stillborn babies, premature births, or babies who require special medical care due to birth defects. That's why I keep saying the plague is not corona. The plague is racist man, racist woman, racist child. That is the plague. This is not an accident to have these type of numbers. And particularly the last couple of years, we've been talking about how this has been widely reported. Wow. Why is there such a high rate of infant mortality rate for black people? Why is there such a high rate of maternal mortality rate for black people? Why is this such a dangerous process and all the rest of it? And, you know, oh my goodness, we've got to do something. This is not by accident. This is long running. Even go back to medical apartheid. Harriet A. Washington, she had that devastating line where she talked about during slavery, it was produced. We need these nigger women to produce as many chillens so we can get more nigger slaves. Soon as slavery ended, it was, whoa, eugenics. Cut all that out. We don't need too many nigger babies running around here. Let's get some sterilization going. Let's see. Continuing, same paragraph, the survey also revealed a high incidence of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease among residents that included emphysema and or chronic bronchitis. That sounds like another respiratory problem way before COVID-19. The 1992 survey indicated that 25% of the population surveyed reported having asthma, 32% of the men and 20% of the women, black male privilege. The survey also reported that 68% of those surveyed indicated that their health problems disappeared when they left the community. There's that word again. If you have to leave in order to be a little bit more healthy, I don't think that qualifies as a community. I don't want to call anywhere my community where when I'm there, my skin is bad, my hair is falling out in patches, I look terrible. And then when I leave and I go stay at some random place I never been, but oh my God, look at that. Now I look better. Well, no, the community is the place where you don't have to worry about all that. That is the community. We don't have that anywhere in the world. I will stop there. Yeah, I'll stop there. I'll double check, see if other folks with us, if they have observations, questions. Again, we will be here every day for the rest of the week. We'll be here tomorrow. Dr. Ruby Lathan will be back with us. We'll be talking about obesity. She's been with us many times. She's a certified health nutritionist. She will be talking about the obesity problem, the importance of eating, how that is contributing to all of this when you don't eat correct things and it destroys your immune system. Just talking about what we've been seeing and why it's so important to be really, really mindful about what you eat. When you are not, there are consequences. Racists, they intend for us to be eating bad. They intend for us to be woofing down chicken wings and potato chips and food that is going to totally destroy our immune system, get us smoking cigarettes and consuming alcohol and eating lots of sugary things and sugary beverages. Man, all the excess weight, improper foods, all of that contributes to really, really poor health, really weak immune system, all by racist design. A major component of counter-racism has to be, hey, I'm going to be doing my best every time out. Eat well. Eat logical. Eat in a way that is working against racism, white supremacy. If that means I need to get some books on what to eat, then that's what I'll be doing. If that means Dr. Layla Africa, Nutricide, the nutritional destruction of the black race, will get you off to a good start. But if you need to get some books, do that. Watch some YouTube channels, do that. But that has got to be a core component of white supremacy racism. Eat well, use logic. Every time I grab that fork, that spoon, that knife, chopsticks, whatever it is, man, as what's on my fork right now, is this helping racist man, racist woman, or is this going towards putting them out of business? Any other folks, observations, questions, thoughts they want to make sure they get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Retired firefighter.
Connected with the book we just finished reading, and you briefly spoke on some of the things that are actually happening now. One thing that's that should be a matter of concern is with the spaces that are being taken up in hospitals with this pandemic. It is a situation to whereas the medical environment have been suggesting that children are now to be born at home in some places because of the hospital space. And that right there, it really is overcomplicating the situation of non-white black people. These books, the recent books that we've been reading, like I said before, it's been it educates a victim of racist white supremacy on how the system of racist white supremacy connects to whereas it is in a most scientific fashion demonstrative towards non-white people, to whereas at the same time you would actually have to have had some sort of study to be able to identify it to other people, because it would seem as though, okay, well, it's just that particular virus, or well, they just are not good at cleaning up things, you know, which is very popular to blame it on the victims themselves. And all the while, if that person has not really did some self study, they will believe those different opinions, those negative opinions. You know, if they didn't do research on their own to see, whereas a much more powerful force that actually has been doing some planning, I mean, spending millions of dollars to accomplish these things. You know, I mean, I would imagine housing projects is not a cheap project to put together. It's millions of dollars that goes along with producing such things, and but at the same time their profit is to maintain the system of racist white supremacy. They're willing to do it, and I would say that something similar can happen. You know, just like I connect the relationship with Haiti and let's say a natural disaster called a tornado, not a tornado, but a hurricane. You know, it's the area is vulnerable. The area is vulnerable. So anything that does come by that only could be considered to be something natural would destroy or, you know, place a lot of harm in the area to the people that's in that area. The same thing is going on right now as we're talking. The same thing is going on right now. You know, and I'm thinking it's only in the beginning stages, to tell you the truth. It's only in the beginning stages of it. You know, more and more information like this is essential. Yes, thank you.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter. A lot of that, very common to blame victims. We're not able to see all of the dastardly deeds of racists. Let's see. I was going to say, we will be here every day for the remainder of the week. Dr. Lathan will be here tomorrow, Nutricide on Thursday, Neutralizing Workplace Racism on Friday, Compensatory Call-In on Saturday. And at this point, we're just picking a date for Dr. Sylvia Hood. Sunday is a possibility. It might be a day later. Next week, but she'll be joining us sometime soon. So every day for the remainder of the week, and then next week we'll have to see about our schedule. Not this coming Sunday, but the Sunday after next. I believe we should have our Global Sunday talk. That should be grand. Get folks back from around the world to kind of reassess where things are a month from when we kind of heard from folks last time around, caller in South Korea and London, Austria, folks kind of dispersed everywhere, Canada, to kind of hear, you know, all right, now we've had a month of this, check back in and see new observations, updates, that sort of thing. From the last time we spoke, the folks in London were not on lockdown and all that. That's what I mean about rapid evolution of all this. When we spoke to last had our Global Sunday talk, people in the UK, they were not under lockdown. Boris Johnson was saying we're not doing all that, you know, shut down everything. Bars were still open and all the rest of it. They didn't do the lockdown and shutting all that stuff down until like the last week to 10 days or so, like almost like at the beginning of the month, where just for scale, like we here in Seattle, we've been on lockdown going on our third week just for scale, like state-issued shutdown and almost a month since, like, library closed and all that stuff. So just for scale. And in addition, things are now shut down and Boris Johnson, the frickin' prime minister, is in the intensive care unit in the UK. Suspected race soldier. I did say that. That's another conversation. But I mean, just in terms of how rapidly, like, people were saying he wasn't taking it serious. And what are you doing? And now, you know, I see you. They had to get a ventilator. He couldn't breathe. Like, he's older, you know, some thought he might even transition. So it has been just amazing to watch the evolution of this over a very short period of time. Incidentally, Global Sunday Talk, the last time around, he was not with us live, but we do have listeners around the world. One of our listeners in China, he wrote in and can take a full bow. This is exactly what he predicted. And I mean exactly. He wrote a very lengthy email. He had experienced all this. He's in China, so he experienced all of this. They're back in functional now. No more lockdown and going about their business as usual. But he said, having gone through all this, black people in the States are going to get really heavily devastated by this. And he mentioned specifically bad diet, not taking care of yourself and all the rest because of racism. It's going to have a devastating impact. He predicted that exactly. Wow. When I was looking at more of the information today, I said, wow, he did say that. You can go back and listen to the Global Sunday Talk from March, and I read his email in its entirety, and he gave a lot of detail since he had already been through this, but lots to share. Anywho, we'll be here every day. Book club on Thursday. Dr. Layla Africa Nutricide. I'll be narrating. Again, if anybody already has that book, you can drop an email or whatever. Just let me know if you already have it, because I will not have my physical copy until like next week, probably the beginning of next week. So just to get us through Thursday, if you already have the book, let me know. Might need an assist. Might not. Hopefully one listener will already have my back. So we'll be ready to roll Thursday, normal time. But Friday, workplace racism, compensatory call in. And then, yeah, if you have participated in the book club, and you have any questions for Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington on what we read, how this applies to what's happening right now. Has folks been, you know, dialing, hey, get on the program and break it down for us. Help us explain what's happening in Chicago. All of that. Get your questions ready and we'll be great. I've always felt like, wow, like we should be super prepared to do an interview now. Like, man, we spent all this time and slowly kind of went through the whole book and looked through the footnotes and everything. Like, let's roll. And should be super motivated given the current events as context. Anywho, any other questions, observations, thoughts folks want to make sure they get in? Grant, we'll assume folks are satisfied. Again, massive appreciation to our narrator, Henry in Chicago. Just yeoman's work, very professional in the midst of all of this. Where it could have been very easy, very understandable. Like, man, it's, you know, a lot of things on my plate. He's an attempted parent. I got a whole lot of, you know, to worry about, my child's academic planning and all the rest of it, and got to make face masks. I don't have time, you know, to do this wacky narration. Like, it's interesting material, but I have to get back to this another day. Had it every time, ready to roll, professionally done. We could have done the epilogue last week. I had it in time. Just, you know, didn't want to be excessive in terms of playing a lot of audio for the last segment. We can take our time and complete. But huge gratitude to Henry in Chicago for steering us to the conclusion. I am looking forward to Nutricide myself. I've not read this book before. I have not read any of Dr. Africa's works in their entirety. So I'm looking forward to correcting that. And I'm looking forward at this moment to be reading this book, to be saying, hey, let's be serious. You know, lots of people, I won't say lots of people, but people that are aware that Dr. Africa passed, and or people that are concerned about, you know, the coronavirus and the death rates. Hey, all in one, we can get a twofer here. We can, I mean, I'm all about, if you want to show gratitude or appreciation to anybody, if they spend any time talking about white supremacy, racism, apply what they taught apply their lessons, their theories, their code, whatever it is that is constructive, that is of some value. If you have some regard for that person once they've transitioned, man, I will apply logical viewpoints, strategies that they suggested. Dr. Africa gave a lot of suggestions about diet, health, nutrition. Folks, you know, say they got some regard for them. He meant something to him, to them. You know, they're sad about his passing. Well, hey, we should be really motivated to pay super attention, study diligently, and apply. Like, oh, yeah, I read Dr. Africa, and you will never see me door dashing McDonald's, Baconator, none of that. Like, sausage biscuit, no way. Read Dr. Africa's work, eating my veggies, eating my fruits, drinking my water. I don't do any of that Coca-Cola and Pepsi and all of that, waste all that time reading Nutricide for. That's the type of motivation that we should have given the current events. And if, you know, we say Dr. Africa, wow, like his passing, that's a part of what made this year so terrible. We lost Dr. Africa. Well, then we should be ready to roll for Thursday and making sure that our plates reflect our appreciation for Dr. Africa, meaning our breakfast plate, dinner plate, lunch plate, brunch plate, brunch plate. Reflects our gratitude for Dr. Africa's scholarship. Right on. If everyone is satisfied, I will just say safety. Stay as safe as you can, regardless of, you know, what your viewpoint is about what is happening. Being safe would still be good under the system of racism. Because there are so many threats, it's not just an illness thing. You've got lots of armed white people. Keep seeing those reports as well. Record gun sales for March. Lots of threats. Saw a different report today. They were talking about global pandemic of domestic violence because you've got so many people that are in a stressful situation. They're confined, not able to go out, sitting at home, confined space. And very common. So it's a lot of things to be stressed about, on edge about, given, you know, the turmoil. Safety. Let's try and stay as safe as we can, given uncertain, confusing times on the plantation. If we will be here tomorrow, and like I said, every day for the rest of the week. So if you have questions, comments, guest suggestions through all this, feel free to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Very excited to have Dr. Lathan back with us on the broadcast tomorrow. Be sure to tune in. Normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Check out her website. Like I said, in fact, you can check out some of the archives when she visited before, some of her earlier visits give key information about this here crisis we're experiencing right now. With that, everybody satisfied? Nothing else they need to get out? Grant. We'll assume folks are good. Much obliged for folks' participation. We'll be here in about 24 hours. Sobriety would be best. That includes cigarettes under conditions of white supremacy. Preserve our brain computer. We will need lots of high-powered thinking to get this problem solved urgently, immediately. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's make sure that we do everything we can to minimize being in contact with a race soldier, especially under these conditions. You do not want to be out and about and have to justify, are you an essential worker? Do you have documentation? Where are you going? You know we're under, I mean, try to minimize being out and about at all, if you can, really. And seriously, I would not be out after dark. I would not be going anywhere. I think the most that I have done is I walked around the house and I felt some type of way about that. Just trying to walk around the house after dark. But other than that, like, nah, I would stay in the house. As too many guns have been purchased, too many anxious whites, race soldiers stay in the house after dark, wait until tomorrow morning, wait till it's daylight to get whatever you need to do. Let's behave as though, you know, these are serious and dangerous times. So in addition to being sober, buckled, and not recklessly out and about anyway, we're going to be safe and strategic about that going out under these conditions. If you are driving, you are always Bluetooth, headset, whatever it is, but I'm not just there dangling talking on my phone. Not going to give any easy excuses under these conditions. I'm focused on the road, not texting and driving, any of that nonsense. I don't want to be stopped under these conditions by a state trooper or anybody else. What in the world? What are you doing? Texting? Blah, 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 and have an accident? Coronavirus is going. Text when you get home. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.